I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome Donovan Rikus. He is the CEO of Ethos Benefits and a certified exit planning advisor. Donovan is redefining employer-sponsored healthcare through fiduciary strategies. We'll talk about what that means, cost transparency, and bold leadership. He's also the producer of the documentary, It's Not Personal, It's Just Healthcare. And that's something you absolutely want to listen to if you get a chance. So if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I've had a number of people from healthcare industry coming on because this is either the number that's rapidly becoming like, I think the number two expense item in businesses. This is a big problem that needs to be fixed. And Donovan is one of the people that's fixing it. Donovan, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Craig. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting as I've talked to different people in your space, I've noticed a lot of them come from different backgrounds. Some, you know, some of them very predictable, like Dr. Dickerson is a doctor. So she's working in healthcare, but you come from, you were a financial advisor.
Yes, that's correct.
So like, were you working for one of the banks or what was it like?
No. So I started in financial services, which is a big industry. I mean, that could mean anything from selling individual health insurance to life insurance to being a financial advisor, maybe even over to what I'm doing now. So I kind of started in financial services, was initially selling like life insurance policies, didn't love it, but I loved the industry. And I loved it because you could work with any client you wanted to, and you could solve any type of problem you wanted to. I just didn't know what that would be. I ended up working my way up to study and get my securities license. And that was at an interesting time. That was during the Obama years. And he was contemplating passing something called the fiduciary rule, which was this crazy, crazy concept that if you were a financial advisor, you would be bound to act in the best interest of your client, not have any conflicts of interest, and be transparent with your compensation to your client. And the industry was freaking out. Like, they did not want this. They did not like it. Financial advisors were trying to figure out what they were going to do. Like, it was just full on panic mode. And I'm kind of coming in during this time. And I'm like, what's the problem here, guys? Like, I don't get it. Isn't that what we do?
Yeah.
You know, so started with that. I did opt to, they, you know, in securities, there is a fiduciary license, which is the highest standard of care from, you know, consultant to client. And that's the route I opted to go. I figured the fiduciary rule wouldn't pass. And if it did, it would be watered down. It's exactly what happened. It didn't pass. It was watered down. Nothing ended up coming of it. So that's the standard I took.
Yeah. Let me jump in there. I had a client back in 2016. So just a few years after that passed, and they wanted to talk about being a fiduciary on their website. And I kept running into a compliance officer. It was like, that's not compliant. That's not compliant. And she smugly threw an 80-page document at me, said, you need to read this. Well, I read it and I came back the next week and I said, hey, if I quote the SEC chairman, would that be compliant? She's like, well, yeah. I said, well, the SEC chairman says that fiduciary is a meaningless term. It's so broad, you could drive a bus through it. And so we actually put that on the website, you know, as the highest authority saying, it doesn't really mean anything. Here's how we do things. So it's kind of interesting when you say that it was watered down. I didn't know that history.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was watered down big time. So, the biggest difference when you're representing a client is like the advice you're going to give, is it going to be fee-based where they can see that, understand what you're doing, and then you're just going to go out regardless and just find them and make the best consulting plan for them, or are you going to sell products that have different commission loads that they don't see, they don't understand? So that was the biggest differentiator, so I opted to go that way where I would just charge my fee. Here's my fee regardless of what we do. And then my job is to make sure I perform annually. And as soon as that's not working, you can leave rather than sell them a mutual fund with a 3% load that's going to cost them to get out of, right?
Right.
So that's kind of where I started. Loved it, was doing incredibly well. And one day a client just kind of asked me, he called me. I could hear the panic in his voice. And he's just telling me, like, hey, my broker said my employee benefits in my company are going to go up 37%. There's nothing he can do. This is the last option. Can you do something? And I could just kind of hear the panic, and I didn't know anything about health insurance at all, but I figured, it's a financial product with an insurance aspect. I can figure this out. And because of that, I said, sure. And I said, send me everything you have. And I said that carefully because I had no idea what data he had, what I would need, like what the problem entailed. I'm just like, yeah, just send me everything. And what was shocking was, he had about 120 employees at the time. That 37% increase was accounted for on one page in about two paragraphs that just said, you're going to pay 37% more. So I'm looking at that as a financial advisor thinking, 120 employees plus the dependents, we got 220 or so subscribers individually. That must mean thousands of claims. If we're talking about pharmacy claims, primary, specialists, urgent care, ER visits, there must be thousands of claims. How are we accounting for this on one page? And the short of it was, after a few weeks, just kind of meeting as many people as I could in the industry, trying to solve the problem, trying to acquire more data than they were providing him. We did that. We actually got the renewal minus 40. So we saved him 3 points under where he was currently. And we didn't decrease benefits. We didn't increase deductibles. We didn't put them in a tighter network. We didn't, none of the typical tricks. So we were able to keep them in a like plan without taking away anything and, mitigating that increase entirely.
So what was behind that? I mean, was it just somebody got bored and said, "Hey, let's just increase the premiums 37%, see if it flies?"
Yeah, I mean, a few things. So, number one, I knew that it was in the broker's best interest. So, brokers get paid a percentage of premium, so they get brokered to sell a risk transfer. The bigger the risk transfer, the bigger the commission. So unfortunately, the premium going up for the employer meant more commission for the broker. So they might have wanted to find an option. Maybe they thought that was too big, but likely what they did is only went to maybe one or two carriers to bundle all the services. So they said, hey, I'm with Blue Cross, I'm gonna look at United, I'm gonna look at Cigna. Nope, that didn't work. Okay, here you go. But what they didn't do was look at any of the claims data, right? If the premium is increasing because the cost of claims, there was no attempt to look at the actual claims data to say, what are the claims? What are those costs? How can we mitigate those? How can we change those? What risk is actually still on the plan? Am I paying for a premium increase for employees that I have already termed this year? Like we paid claims for those members, but now they're not part of the team anymore. What's going on there? Like that wasn't part of the equation.
And one of the things that hits me, so I buy my own insurance, and in a couple of weeks, I'm about to have a 20% increase. And now I don't have, we're not big enough that we have where we're able to do a self-funded or anything like that. And it just leaves me feeling helpless. And I'm on a grandfathered plan from pre-ACA, and anybody I talk to in the industry says hang on to that, but it's like stupid. I used to pay $90 a month, And now it's in 2 weeks, it's going to be 800 a month. And except for 3 years of my life, I don't use it.
I mean, that's where most people are, and you see a lot of employees just foregoing that because of the cost of the premiums. It's too much to come out of your paycheck before anything else, you know. Taxes and health insurance, you're left with not much after to take care of your family.
Yeah. Well, now employers that do self-funded plans have, a few more options. Actually, let me pause before we go there. There's a term you've used a couple times, and I think it's one of these confusing terms. There's somebody in the financial services industry that spends over 100 million a year in marketing, and he goes around and says, "We're different. We're a fiduciary." And I'm like, shut up. No, you're not different. There's 450,000 financial advisors out there. You all do the same thing using basically the same tools. And nobody knows what a fiduciary means except for the chairman of the SEC. Now, the term fiduciary has been brought into healthcare. What does it mean in the context of healthcare?
So interestingly, it's always been a part of healthcare because it's under ERISA. Right. So that's also what governs 401k plans and pension plans. So that's been around since 74. So ERISA does apply to healthcare plans, and it's supposed to mean the highest standard of care. And the biggest thing, you know, as a company, the CEO, the CFO, the HR, anybody part of that decision-making framework also has a fiduciary duty, but to the employees. Right. So they have a duty of prudence, of loyalty, of compliance. And as an advisor, the funny thing is, like, the employer who's trying to make that decision has that standard of care to their employees. And what we're starting to see now is healthcare lawsuits, employee against employer. But then the employer goes and hires a insurance salesman to consult them on a problem they don't understand, who doesn't have that standard of care to them. So the standard of care for an insurance advisor is suitable. I mean, anything on the market that I can sell you that's a bona fide insurance product is suitable for you to purchase. It doesn't mean it's optimal. It doesn't mean it's meeting your goals. It doesn't mean it's sustainable. So the flipping, bringing fiduciary into healthcare for us means that our fees are 100% transparent with the employer when we're making that arrangement, that there's no back end commission that's going to make me prefer this carrier over that one, and just kind of always working in their best interest, not having those kind of backdoor indirect compensation that is just all over the industry.
Now, how does it, okay, and before I go there, if I have a business that has fewer than 50 employees, am I exempt from the fiduciary rule?
No.
Really? Is anybody exempt?
No. But you are, you know, it is a little bit different because in that marketplace, you are going to be inherently more limited, right? You're likely going to be on a fully funded plan, and what you can do, your scope is limited. So there was some legislation in 2021 in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021. And what that did was set forth like some minimum standards that employers are supposed to do to meet their fiduciary requirement. So one of those things is eliminating gag clauses, essentially what the insurance companies try to do to prevent any of that data coming to you as the employer to help you make a decision. So that first case that I got, that was gagged, right? Here's 37% increase, can't tell you why, can't tell you what happened, how much it costs, what we're expecting for next year, can't tell you that. So gag clause just elimination, right? Disclosing, does my contract have gag clauses, trying to remove those. Second thing was RxDC, so benchmarking of your pharmacy costs, your top 50 drugs. So what are you paying through your pharmacy benefit manager versus cash prices versus other PBMs? And then the last thing was broker compensation disclosure, actually understanding that before you enter into an agreement.
Yeah. So, nuts and bolts for employers. So they have a fiduciary responsibility. Who's the fiduciary?
So the fiduciary could be anybody that's part of the decision-making process. If you have a benefits committee, it could be that, but usually at minimum, it's going to be CEO, CFO, HR, if they're all in that. So what we've started to see starting January last year is lawsuits. So it started with Johnson & Johnson, moved on to JP Morgan, or Wells Fargo and JP Morgan. And they not only included, the CEO, CFO, HR, they included former HR that helped make the decision last year personally, the board on the companies that helped and had a decision-making process in that as well. So it kind of just depends how those decisions are made in each company. But anybody that has a hand in it is kind of personally responsible.
Wow. So one of the things I've heard that happens is and it's kind of clever because I know the insurance industry has pretty strict rebate laws, and it seems like they found a way around the rebate law. So a health an insurance provider will own a PBM, pharmacy benefit manager. Pharmacy benefit manager will get rebates from the drug from the pharma companies, and then they'll kick that back to the healthcare company that owns them, and it like totally escapes the whole rebate rule.
Yeah, any fully funded plan will operate that way. So, I mean, drugs might, a lot of drugs are rebated at 50, 60, 70% of the cost of the drug. So, the way they account for that in the end of the year, they'll tell the employer, hey, you spent 10 grand on this drug, if they account for it at all, right? So, they'll say, hey, you spent 10 grand. There's 5 grand of rebates coming back, but they don't credit that back to the cost of the drugs.
Wow. How does fiduciary responsibility work out in terms of tracking through that?
So that's the majority of the lawsuits that we've seen early on have been about the pharmacy benefit manager, because that is a really, really easy part of your healthcare plan to fix. Like, it is very easy to benchmark the cost of drugs. So when that first lawsuit came out in January last year, what I did is I went through the lawsuits, like 120 pages about, they had referenced 35 drugs for Johnson and Johnson. Johnson & Johnson has like 160,000 employees. Okay. So they referenced the cost that their PBM was paying for those drugs versus the cash price. And I took that cost of drugs and I ran it against my clients that might only have 200 employees. And what we came out with was a 93% cost differential on what Johnson and Johnson's PBM was agreeing to pay versus what our clients were.
Wow. That's massive. And I'm not a big fan of the weight loss drugs, but a lot of people are on those and they're expensive.
Most healthcare plans disallow them for the purposes of healthcare, so for A1C, diabetes, that kind of stuff. They'll usually allow it. Occasionally, we'll see it. We're going through one right now. The company has $10 million a year in drug spend, and 3 million of it is GLP-1s.
Wow.
So it's just been an astronomical category of drug spend recently. I don't even know if, we're kind of just starting at them. I don't know if they're aware that they're doing it for weight loss, if they've had that discussion, if they know how much of their spend it is, but I mean, it's a huge problem.
I've known some people in GLP-1s, and I don't want to say the brand on air here, but at one point, I just told a family member who's postmenopausal. I said, "You know that one third of the weight loss is muscle, lean matter, and bone mass." And she had no idea. And I wonder. I mean, this is a little bit askew from what we're talking about, but it seems like one of the things that we need to do to bring down healthcare costs is we need to figure out how to get people eating less and exercising more.
Yeah, certainly a component of it. And I've certainly seen that muscle loss on friends and associates on GLP-1s.
Yeah. It's horrible. I mean, I told you earlier, I was just getting over the flu. I lost 5 pounds just with the flu, and I felt, my wife at one point said, "You're getting really skinny, and it doesn't look good." She actually said, "You look vulnerable," and I think it was all muscle loss.
Imagine doing that for months.
Is there a way for health, to work fitness, work these type of things, weight loss in the healthcare plans?
I mean, there is. That was a trend, I'd say, 5 to 10 years ago, a lot of focus on wellness. With the way people change jobs, like it's a very, it's more of like an HR and engagement thing than it is like a cost reduction measure with the way turnover is. And people don't stay at their jobs for their entire life like they used to. So it's very hard to tie any type of wellness program to any measurable change in healthcare spend. I wish there was, but the way we view that is more of an engagement, something good to do for the employees. But for my purposes, I'm usually focusing on the things that I can absolutely do. Because fundamentally, the problem with most healthcare plan design is when the broker brings another renewal increase, their suggestions are what can the employees do for you to reduce it? So they tell the employer, you need to tell your people to use telemedicine more. They should be using urgent care instead of the ER, and they should be filling generic drugs. Now, all those things are good policy, and you should be, putting that out there. But that's the question of what can the employees do for you as the employer when the employer has all the leverage to make good decisions to affect the employees. So, wellness and workout programs and all that stuff is great, but what we focus on is like, as the employer, what can we do to make sure employees have low costs, high access, and good healthcare navigation, and then, maybe a wellness program.
Now, the plans you put together, do those have deductibles? I know some folks are driving down deductibles. What are you doing?
We try to. So it kind of always depends on where we start from, right? So rather than this being a reactive annual, kind of 9 months out, quick make a decision, we're putting out a 5-year business plan essentially for the healthcare spend. It is a business unit, like you mentioned earlier before we kind of went on air. It's usually the second or third highest cost in a business, so it deserves and it needs that kind of planning. So we're trying to get there. We also do direct primary care a lot, where employees have access to their primary same day, next day, 30, 60-minute visit times. They can do blood work there, stitches, get generic medicines, like a very comprehensive visit. That helps a lot as well. And then another thing we use that I think is really, really underutilized is 501R programs. 501R programs is a financial assistance program for all not-for-profit hospitals that already exists. It's a federal program. They have to have it. And employees can qualify for either partial or full assistance of their entire deductible. So whatever their cost share is, that can be covered by the hospital. It's just that hospitals don't share that. They don't want to get that program out there. So we kind of assist in the communication, but also the support of filling that out, getting that done for the employees. And that's something great that we can do right away. And the income limits are actually pretty high if you're talking about like a family of two or three.
No, that's cool. What would be some, so for an employer that's, they've been looking at, they've been seeing their healthcare expense go up. A lot of them are, I think, trying to figure out whether to pass it off to the employees or what to do. Is it, can they afford it anymore? So as we kind of wrap up, what would be for employers listening, what would be your advice to them?
It's the simplest answer is the right one. It's in the claims. So it's funny, when I started telling HR that, I was like, this is so simple, it's going to make sense, right? Like, what we need to do is reduce the frequency and severity of claims. However, when companies heard that, they heard reduce the frequency and severity of medical conditions, right? Like what the employees have. That's not what we're talking about at all. A claim is a request for dollars for a covered incident. And those dollars can be wildly variable. I know you had that experience with hospital visits in the past too, right? I think everybody has. The If we send 10 people in the same hospital with the same condition, same age, same sex, but 10 different insurance cards, we leave with 10 different rates, right? Everybody's going to have a different amount that they owe, that also the insurance company owes. So, same thing with drugs, understanding that the costs are variable. If you don't know where you benchmark in that, I promise you it's not on the good end. And we've given that responsibility up to our health insurance companies, assuming that they want to keep costs low because they want to keep us as a client and their job is to keep the cost of healthcare low. But that's not what we've seen. And kind of what I leave with people, and I try to even open up meetings with this kind of thought and this consideration, is that the purpose of any system is what it does. So we can't say the purpose of a system is something that it repeatedly fails to do. So I don't think we can say that the purpose of health insurance is to keep the cost of care low if we looked at the past 20 years. Either they're utterly failing in that, or that's not the purpose. So with that in mind, getting to the bottom of the actual claim cost, demanding that transparency, and then understanding those costs, because for a lot of companies, if they do get data, they'll get stuff that says, like, all right, this year you spent $227,000 in heart, 160 in spine. It's like, what does that mean? Like, is that 160 at chiropractors? Like, do we do spinal fusions? Like, what's going on here? Right. We have to understand what is the actual procedures, what do we pay? What's the benchmark in my area, in my state? What can I do to improve that?
Cool. Well, if somebody wants to talk to you about their health plan, their company plan, how did they reach you?
LinkedIn is probably the best. Also, our website, ethosbenefits.com, and I have the documentary up there as well for screening.
Right, that was going to be my next question. So if I want to see the documentary, it's on your LinkedIn page
If it's not on my
or
LinkedIn page, I'll put it on there today, actually. I'm not really sure, but it's on our
okay.
website, ethosbenefits.com. You can find the website from my LinkedIn if not, and it's under there. The film is called It's Not Personal, It's Just Healthcare. Really goes through this problem from all perspectives, you know, hospitals, insurance executives, physicians, nurses, pharmacy benefit managers, kind of explaining each their piece of the problem, but also a framework for getting out of it.
Wow. Well, Donovan, I really appreciate what you're doing. I think, I told you in the green room, I don't think the system can bear up under its own weight over the next five to 6 years. And I think what you're doing is not just helping employers, but I think you guys are building a life raft to help us find the path forward in healthcare in this country. So thanks for that. And I do hope people reach out to you. Thanks for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
Awesome. Thank you, Craig.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show. And it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.